Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might know me as one of the co-authors to Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, or the upcoming Real Life Paleo books. But what you'll find out on this show is that I really like to talk about tangents and soapboxes, and definitely about lifting heavy things.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm the author of two books, The Paleo Approach and the upcoming companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm a huge nutrient density geek, and I just can't help talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. So, Sarah, we have kind of a special guest on already with us this week.
We have a super special guest. I'm, like, so excited. We can't even talk to each other now because we just have to, like, introduce our guest, like, right off the top.
So, Mark Sisson, welcome back to the Paleo View.
Thanks for having me back. Must mean that I did okay the first time.
You definitely passed the test.
So, the first time we had you on this show, I was so nervous. Stacey remarked afterwards, she's like, you could totally tell. My mom listened to the show and she's like, Sarah, what was going on with you? And I was like, we had Mark Sisson on the show. And I promise to be cooler this time and not so like trying not to girl fan on you.
Oh, well, whatever. Your mom probably said, Mark who?
No.
My mom knows who Mark Sisson is. My mom has a major, major crush. Yeah, I keep telling her that you're happily married, but she doesn't seem to get it.
I am, but it's always nice that, you know, it's always nice to hear that. Whatever.
Just start off our podcast by embarrassing Mark Sisson.
You know what? Not everybody can do that. I've got a skill.
It's a special skill.
Actually, I'm sure it'll be in the blooper section, but before the show, I was trying to embarrass Mark by talking about bodily fluids and inappropriate things. So it's just it's going along with the theme.
And then I tried to one-up you.
Yeah, you did.
You successfully one-upped her, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So, Mark, for those people who don't know, Mark Sisson is the brains behind Mark's Daily Apple and the series of books related to Primal Blueprint, and is also associated with publishing many Paleo and Primal cookbooks coming out last year and this year. Some good stuff going on with you, Mark. So how are you? And do you want to kind of give maybe a little couple minute spiel on yourself for people who might not know, and then the things you've got going on, new and exciting?
Sure. I'm great. Thanks for asking. And business is good, and I see continued growth in the ancestral health space, so that's always great. I started my own base of operation here in 2006 with my blog, Mark's Daily Apple, and was writing a lot every day for years and years, trying to put forth my ideas. The blog grew reasonably quickly, although not fast enough, as it turns out, in everybody's ultimate plans. But it's now become the largest ancestral health blog in the world, and we're proud of that. Continue to explore areas of health, fitness, diet, exercise, medicine to a certain extent. And with the platform of Mark's Daily Apple, started publishing books, which included The Primal Blueprint, my initial book, and now we have seven books in the Primal Blueprint series and a number of other authors that we publish. We make supplements that we design to kind of fit within the primal lifestyle. We have events like Primal Con, which is a three-day experience where people come and actually live the sort of idealized primal blueprint life for 3 days, including the foods, getting the sleep dialed in, learning how to do the exercises that we talk about, how to move the body without getting injured and increasing fitness and mobility, learning how to cook. So those are very popular events. We are just now introducing the Primal Blueprint Expert Certification, which is a very exciting new extension of what we do, allowing other people to learn and be tested on their knowledge and skills in the area of Primal Blueprint coaching so that people can add to their resume. If you're a LPN or an RN or a physician or a physician's assistant or a dietitian or nutritionist or personal trainer or just a person who wants to prove to the world that you know this stuff. It's a very detailed online course. It's 13 modules. There's a test at the end of each module. You have to pass that test to move on to the next level. But when you pass, you can call yourself a Primal Blueprint certified expert and use that on your business cards or in your business or with your clients or with your family just to sort of say, look, I know what I'm talking about when I suggest that we eat this way. So we're very excited about that. That's just launched. And I think that's the update, ladies.
Not, you don't have anything going
Nothing else going on.
Yeah, it's just one or two things. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about your certification program. I'm sort of like picturing, you know, housewives across the country getting certified so they can force their families to eat the food that they cook.
Force their families to eat the food they cook. I like the way you think. What kind of parenting is that? That's like 50s parenting, right?
It's so. Definitely.
So eat it or go to your room.
Right. Exactly. That's what there is to eat.
Yeah.
That's what you have for breakfast.
Well, I think it's an interesting approach to say, even just for the person that wants to learn for themselves so that they can tell people in their lives that they're an expert. I think there's a validity to that because people ask Sarah and I on the podcast all the time about like, well, how do you convince, you know, your family and friends that, you know what you're talking about. And at this point, Sarah and I's response is, well, we wrote books on it. Like, you know, people in our lives actually stop asking us because they're kind of convinced that we know a thing or two. But that's a kind of a good alternative is not
now
just...
Now you can add to that, yeah. I'm a Primal Blueprint certified expert.
Exactly.
So there.
Yeah. So cool. And also, I wanted to mention that... I tried your grass-fed, it's called Primal Fuel, right? The whey protein?
Yes.
And I am still, sadly, intolerant to whey, but it tasted really good. I tried it actually at the picnic truck in Austin. Have you tried your own bulletproof coffee there?
My own bulletproof coffee there? At the picnic truck, and I'm trying to think, who was there representing? Do you remember?
So at Paleo FX, like... a couple of blocks from where they do it is this food truck.
Right. That's right. I walked by the food truck. I didn't stop in, but I saw that they were using Primal Fuel.
Oh, you got to go there. They'd geek out because they sell your Primal Fuel there and they put it in like coffees. They make like bulletproof coffees and mochas and all that kind of stuff with your fuel there. And I got all excited and I was like, oh, I've been meaning to try this because I don't do well with a lot of whey, but maybe grass-fed whey will work. And it didn't, sadly, but it was delicious.
So here's the deal. Just you brought up an interesting point. It's not grass-fed whey. It's whey protein isolate, which is the gold standard for whey. But of note, when you use whey protein isolate, what you are doing is you are concentrating the amino acids, the amino acid profile of the whey, and it's got one of the highest, best-rated amino acid profiles of any protein source, including egg albumin and pea protein and rice bran and casein, all the milk proteins and so on. But what you're doing is you are eliminating the fats when you are concentrating the whey protein isolate, when you're concentrating the amino acids. So when you get rid of the fats, it doesn't matter that it was grass-fed or not because the only reason to buy grass-fed beef is for the fatty acid profile. You know what I mean?
Fascinating.
Yeah, the amino acid profile between a grain-fed cow and a grass-fed cow is exactly the same. It's the fatty acid profile that's going to differ. Now, we can talk a little bit about, you know, the health of the cows that were grain-fed and whether or not they were given antibiotics and hormones, and I'm certainly not in favor of that. I'm opposed to that. But there are ways to get to a grain-fed animal or a grass-fed grain-finished animal that didn't have antibiotics and other nasty things injected into the diet that still yields the same exact amino acid profile that you would find in grass-fed beef. That makes sense?
That makes complete sense. So I have like three follow-up questions. So
This is how I go through life. I'll explain something, and then there's not just one follow-up question, but three follow-up.
Well, it's like you stir the pot and it starts bubbling,
exactly,
you know?
But that's exactly why Mark's Daily Apple. I said in year one, in 2006, I'll write something every day for a year, and by then I'll have run out of everything to write about, so I'll just stop blogging. Well, all it did was, you know, just like you guys, every time I wrote a post, it, three more questions arose from that. So I get it.
I have a list of about 300 blog posts that I'm meaning to write that are completely related to questions I've had. Yep. Okay, so my first question is a good quality whey protein isolate casein-free?
Yes, absolutely.
And since it's water-soluble, right? Because it's a lysed amino acid. So do you get water-soluble vitamins sort of piggybacking on it, or is it pretty much pure amino acid with no other micronutrients?
Yeah, the real intention of whey protein isolate is to deliver amino acids, a collection of amino acids in a profile that is best for human consumption. And when I make that caveat, I'll give you an example. I've seen companies now offering up grass-fed beef protein isolate. And I'm going, okay, because, you know, the whey is a byproduct of the cheese manufacturing, so it's more from the dairy industry, but what you're doing is getting rid of the fats and you're getting rid of the casein, and you're isolating the amino acids. Now, I've seen these offerings of beef protein isolate, grass-fed beef protein isolate. And it's always been suspect to me, and as I dig deeper, what I start to realize is that, first of all, you wouldn't take a great piece of grass-fed steak, which you're going to pay $30 a pound for minimum at most stores anyway, and then desiccate it and grind it up into a powder and put it in a bag and sell it to people to reconstitute with water. Well, where do they get this beef protein isolate? They get it from the nether parts of the cow. So it was a grass-fed cow. They took off the grass-fed meat. They left the skull, the knuckles, the brains, the, you know, everything else. They boiled it down. They made a gelatin, which is legit. Gelatins of, you know, we do it all the time in the kitchen for using the offal part of the animal. But it's a bit of a stretching of the truth to suggest that beef protein isolate would be somehow superior. Because what you see is that it's higher in some of the amino acids that are found in gelatin. Now, that's fine because a lot of people would take gelatin for their joints, for their hair and skin and nails and so on and so forth, but don't call it, you know, don't market it as a superior form of an amino acid profile because it's got a few amino acids that have been rendered by this very destructive process in rendering all of these parts into a gelatin and then spray drying it and so on and so forth. I'm going way afar.
No, I'm like psychotically in love with what you just said because
love the idea of all the nether regions being boiled down and put.
Listen, I know I could talk about nether regions all day long. We've already discussed this. No, because I have been successfully using egg white protein and have found it to be very helpful for me in terms of performance and improvement in muscle mass, and I was on AIP for so long that I was really worried that when I introduced egg protein that I would be unsuccessful, but I've had really excitingly good luck with it. And when I was considering my options, people were talking about this beef protein that you're talking about, and something just didn't feel right to me. And I guess kind of the way that you described it before you went in and did the research, it kind of like, I don't know about that. And I've been lingering on not looking into it for like 2 or 3 months just because the egg white's been working for me, and I like the idea of eating beef when I want beef. And I'm also adding gelatin just because I do really well with additional collagen in my diet, not because it's a full amino acid profile, but because I have an autoimmune disease that requires that. So it's really fascinating and wonderful that you just rattled that off without us even knowing that you were going to, because it's really helpful for me to know that my instincts were kind of right in thinking it doesn't make sense to make a beef protein. Although, you know, for someone who is on autoimmune protocol, like it was impossible to find any sort of protein supplement other than obviously whole animal, but I don't have a gallbladder and I have digestive issues. And so post-workout, I wasn't able to consume anything for like an hour or more because I literally couldn't digest anything. And so the protein smoothies have been really helpful in that I can, it's like already pre-digested for me a little bit. So if someone was in that sort of circumstance and couldn't do whey or egg white, it would probably be better than nothing. But I love that you addressed that with the depth that you did. So thanks.
Sure. And to take it just one step further. So once I found that out, I started getting samples from some of the suppliers of this so-called beef protein isolate with the intent of selling a bone broth supplement, a powdered bone broth supplement, because that's really what it is. You know what I mean? And it's not an amino acid profile that you're trying to recreate with like you would with gold standard whey protein isolate or even the albumin protein that you've been having success with. But in fact, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. It just means you shouldn't sell it as that. And so I thought, well, I've got my great whey protein isolate meal replacement product. Maybe I'll consider adding a bone broth supplement product using this raw material. But alas, I couldn't get it to taste right.
Yeah, that's another thing. Is I was like, how am I going to put that in a smoothie? It's going to taste like burger.
Yeah, well, it just tastes – I mean, first of all, whey protein isolate doesn't taste great to begin with. That's one of the reasons that most of the forms you'll find it in have to have sweeteners and artificial flavors just to make it halfway palatable, because otherwise you won't – you know, you'll plug your nose every time you drink it. That's one of the sort of qualities of most protein isolates is they just – amino acids don't taste that great by themselves, so you have to doctor them up. Now, with Primal Fuel, the strategy we use, which I'm really pleased and proud of, is we used a lot of coconut milk powder. So as you said, the taste is pretty fabulous. I mean, in fact, most people who taste Primal Fuel say it's the best-tasting meal replacement they've ever had. And that's mixing it with water. If you start mixing it with cream or with coconut milk, it's to die for, as they say. So it's a great tasting product, and it took me 2 years to get the flavor profile right, doing so with natural flavors and natural sweeteners. And by the way, sucrose is a natural sweetener, and there's a little bit of sucrose in it. So let's get that off the table right now. It's pure evaporated cane sugar, you know, 1 gram per dose. But, you know, it's interesting that back to the bone broth thing and trying to create a bone broth supplement, the direction I took was to try to create one that you could make hot, that you could mix with warm water, and it would have a more savory taste. So there'd be a little garlic, a little onion, a little something that, you know, you might do with a bone broth preparation. I gave up because I couldn't make it work.
So So I have like a backtrack question. So how long are the peptide chains typically in protein hydrolysates? Do you know?
They're di and tripeptides for the most part. That's the longest you'll get as a tripeptide. But
so why is there such a flavor difference between different protein isolates? Or is there not really? They're just all kind of bitter and icky.
Well, there is a flavor difference. Sometimes, and depending on the quality of the final preparation, for instance, whey protein concentrate still has lactose, still has traces of casein, still has a little bit of fat left in it. That's the nature of whey protein concentrate. That's why isolate is the gold standard. One step down is concentrate, it's often why you'll see a lot of mixtures, blends of egg albumin protein, pea protein, whey protein isolate. Part of that is to reduce the cost, because whey protein isolate is the highest costing version. In fact, I get a little bit upset when I hear guys like Mercola suggest that whey protein concentrate is a better form because A, it's not, and B, it costs half of what I pay for the whey protein isolate to get to where I'm at. But a lot of people use a blend. They'll blend the isolate. They'll blend some egg albumin. They'll some pea protein. And that'll maybe reduce some of the or neutralize some of the the flavor profiling. But yeah, you always, even though they might taste slightly different, they all taste kind of nasty unless you add in some form of a lot of them add in artificial sweeteners, and that's horrendous. But even if you add in stevia and a little bit of flavoring, it's still sometimes they're pretty difficult to choke down.
Well, especially because stevia is gross. But so, okay, follow-up question then. If it's di- and tripeptides, why do, like, say, people who have dairy sensitivities still have problems with a high-quality whey hydrosylate?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because I do encounter people who are very they're perfectly okay with Primal Fuel. In fact, they'll say, this is the first product that I've used that I was able to digest and not have issues with. Despite my being wickedly lactose intolerant my whole life. So I do encounter people like that. I guess some people are just so absolutely sensitive that maybe it wasn't the lactose that was the issue for you. You know, maybe it was some other component of dairy that was an issue. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is because I've seen it both ways. I've seen some people say they still can't consume it. Rob Wolf is one of the people who he gets Primal Fuel for all of his employees and they love it and it's a great he's a huge endorser of it, and yet he says I still have the occasional mild discomfort enough to choose not to take it. So I don't know what the answer is to that.
I had really hoped that it would work for me because I had heard really great things about it as well, but didn't want to invest in buying a whole big bag if I wasn't going to be successful with it. So trying it at Picnic was a perfect opportunity, and man, I wished it worked. But I always thought that it was because I do really well on low lactose foods. You know, like I do really well on heavy cream, but if I switch to half and half, I react. And so because it's not bound in the fat is kind of just what I assumed. Like I think I do better with the fats than with the proteins.
It sounds like it, with a heavy cream being the litmus test.
Yeah. So Sarah, are you done with your like 18 questions? Because I want to backtrack to one.
I clearly underestimated the number of follow-up questions I had, but I was just geeking out and interested and
Well, there's your science.
When do you have Mark Sisson on your podcast to just answer all of your geeky questions?
It needed to be said, right?
Completely.
Well, I think so. One of the things that I kind of have a question to that I hope we can lead into another thing that I wanted to talk to you about is you mentioned the sucrose, and I think it's really worth talking about. Sarah and I are big believers in not being perfectionists and also acknowledging that real sweeteners are safer and easier for the body to digest. But something that I've been finding the more that I am an athlete, which is weird for me to say, but that I do really well with eating higher carbs, and even if they're refined, post-workout. And, you know, whether Sarah and I had a podcast once where she kind of addressed that it's more of a myth than a fact in terms of the post-workout window and all that kind of stuff. But I think, especially for me, having been metabolically broken, having that opportunity to take advantage of my insulin being a little more forgiving post-workout, I think, especially when you're designing something like Primal Fuel, where people are, or should be, perhaps, actually, I don't like the word should, but it is designed to be consumed for most people around a workout window. And therefore, it would be logical to me that something would have a carbohydrate sweetener in it rather than kind of a phony sweetener, because it shouldn't be a shock to the system to kind of have a little bit of sweetener or carbohydrate at that time. So that said, I don't know if you want to say any more kind of on that topic, but I wanted to put it out there because I do think that, you know, there's like this fear of sweetener in the community. But also because I wanted to talk more about that post-workout carbohydrate window and your thoughts on just carbohydrates in general. And we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I could riff on this for an hour, so shut me up when you've heard enough. But basically, when you are a sugar burner and you've derived most of your energy, even in workouts, from sugar, and certainly throughout the day from depending on a regular source of carbohydrate, that's a good time to take advantage of that post-workout window of opportunity, which I had been talking about for 10 years before I even started the Primal Blueprint, because I'd been a big fan of carbohydrate loading and maximizing glycogen resynthesis. But all of that was predicated on the assumption that when I finish my workout today, I need to restore my glycogen because I've got to do something tomorrow. And so therein lies one of the discussion points, the philosophy of, well, what does a workout look like for you? Because if you're working out so hard that you deplete all glycogen today and then you feel that you have to replenish all your glycogen in anticipation of working out hard tomorrow, I'm going to ask you all kinds of philosophical questions like, okay, why are you doing that? What's your goal? Is your goal to work out for the sake of working out and beat yourself up every single day? Or is your goal to be fit, lean, strong, happy, healthy, productive, and all those things you say you want with the least amount of pain, suffering, sacrifice, discipline, working out every day, calorie counting, making sure you consume 80% carbohydrate solution after a workout? Those are some basic philosophical questions. Now, within the Primal Blueprint, we suggest, you move around a lot at a low level of activity throughout the week. So walking, hiking, easy bike riding, whatever it is that means for you. And then you really only need to do two hard workouts a week and sprint once a week to maximize, or at least come very close to optimizing, shall we say, maybe not maximizing, but optimizing your fitness and your health. With that in mind, if you're going to lift every 3 or 4 days, when you get home from the gym, it's not imperative that you resynthesize glycogen for tomorrow, because if you went as hard as you needed to today to get the sort of genetic response that you're trying to prompt, the epigenetic response that you're trying to prompt, then you shouldn't be able to work out hard tomorrow. You should take a day off tomorrow or take an easy day tomorrow, because your liver and your muscles are going to resynthesize glycogen no matter what you eat. They're just going to do it at a slower rate than if you slammed down 100 grams of carbohydrate in a drink post-workout. So two things happen, two choices, two paths you can take at the end of a hard workout if you've been doing any heavy lifting or metabolic conditioning type work. One is you can say, okay, and this is what I do. I go into my workouts fasted. I do a hard workout, but it doesn't last over an hour, usually 35 or 40 minutes. I go home and I don't eat for 2 hours. Well, why would I do that? Well, I do that because I'm trying to generate growth hormone and testosterone from the workout. And that's my goal. My goal is to maximize the effects of this workout through the changes that are prompted in the biochemical after effects of the work that I'm doing that are going to prompt my muscles to get stronger and to grow and to do whatever it is I'm intending to have them do. And in my mind, I'm accomplishing that by not eating. Now, the other choice I could do is I could say, okay, I'm gonna take the other approach, which is at the end of the workout, I'm going to go home and immediately within that 45-minute window of opportunity, which is, again, kind of nebulous, but let's just assume it exists, and I'm going to slam down 80 grams of carbohydrate and maybe 20 grams of protein, because that's what the conventional wisdom is, with the idea that I'm going to synthesize glycogen faster and fill the muscles up. Well, what that does is that raises insulin, which then blunts the growth hormone and the testosterone effects. So I get two choices. One is to sort of go into it fasted, not eat, do the workout and not eat after the workout and maximize those hormonal responses, or go in and resynthesize glycogen by consuming a lot of carbohydrate and blunt the hormonal responses I was looking for, but accomplish another task, a choice, neither right nor wrong, good or bad, and that choice is to replenish glycogen so that I can go hard again tomorrow. So, all of these things that we talk about throughout the paleo primal world, they're just choices, and you try to make those choices based on the best information you have available to you, and you try to make those choices based upon the goals that you've set for yourself. So my goal when I was a runner was absolutely to run 15 miles today and then consume over the course of a day 700 to 1,000 grams of carbohydrate so that I could go run 15 or 20 miles tomorrow. And that was what you did when you were a marathon runner or a triathlete. Those days are behind me now. And my goal now is to maximize my body mass because I'm 61 years old. And the main thing for me now is I want to maintain lean body mass because that's the real indicator of longevity. And so the goal isn't to tear myself down or beat myself up. It's actually to build myself up with what Tim Ferriss would call the minimum effective dose. What's the least amount of exercise that I can do that's going to make me work really hard and bust my butt, but is going to have the impact that I want, largely so I don't have to do it every day, so that I can do it as infrequently as possible and still get the results. And oh, by the way, so that I can use those results to have fun, to play, so I can play Frisbee on the weekend, so that I can go paddling with my friends and have fun instead of considering it a workout, so that I can go snowboarding, so that I can do all these fun things because I'm strong enough, fit enough, and gosh darn it, I'm good enough.
We love a good SNL reference.
You remember that? Okay. I got sidetracked there. But
we're old enough to remember that. Don't worry.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, so that's the that's the shortened 30-minute version of it. But does that make sense to you?
Yes. Well, we have follow-up questions.
Yeah, I know Sarah has a follow-up question. I think for me personally, just to clarify, what I'm doing post-workout is eating mostly protein with some carbohydrate. I find that that works really well for me. I'm curious about the mechanisms, but as we all do in the community, in doing some N equals one experimentation with my goals, which are different than your goals, which is to be a strength athlete, and I do enjoy beating myself up. I'm not really quite sure, but I always leave the gym bruised on purpose. So it's, you know, I definitely have a different
bruises
goal.
Bruises aren't on purpose. It's not like you like take something and smash it into your arm and be like, woohoo, I just bruised myself.
No, I'm pretty sure when I'm lifting and pressing that keg that I'm bruising myself on purpose, but that's neither here nor there.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but that's, helpful and interesting, and yes, it makes sense. So go ahead, Sarah.
Well, just 17 or 18 follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really fascinated about the mechanisms behind testosterone and growth hormone increasing and requiring a low insulin environment to do that, because after I finished the paleo approach, I had a complete adrenal burnout and ended up testosterone and progesterone deficient. And one of the things that I have been doing to bring myself back that has been like one of the best things I've ever done in my life is I took up CrossFit. And so I've been lifting heavy things a few times a week. And I prefer to work out fasted, and I prefer to not eat for a couple of hours after I work out. And it's just been what my body's been telling me to do. And of course, I've been testosterone deficient, so I'm wondering if I'm sort of intuitively maximizing my testosterone. But I would love if you could give like the just some more detail into the mechanism behind that, because that wasn't something I knew, and I like learning.
Yeah, I mean it's a CNS, it's a central nervous system response. The hypothalamic pituitary axis. There's a lot of inner talk and interconnection between these, but I think the bottom line is that from a survival standpoint through evolution, the ability to work hard and hunt for a beast and then not catch a beast, but still survive and benefit from that may have something to do with that. Beyond that, the mechanism is as laid out in the research. So I'm not even sure that beyond I could go into the excruciating detail of why that happens. But it has been written about many times, and not many times, but enough times that I'm a believer that that's probably what's going on. And that's probably the best use of my strategy for where I am in my life right now.
So it's activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and production of testosterone along with cortisol from the adrenal glands?
Yeah, there's some crosstalk, because obviously when you do an intense workout like that, there'll be a release of cortisol. So as far as long as you're not burned out because of chronic stress.
Or yeah.
As long as it's an acute stressor, then the benefits are desired. And that gets us into that discussion about some of the, not just CrossFit, but some of the workout strategies. P90X would be a good example of that, where, you know, you do 3 days on, 3 days hard, and 1 day off. And that's just too much for some people. And that becomes its own chronic stressor.
Yeah, that would be too much for me, that's for sure.
Yeah, but that's the sort of outline and the plan for a lot of these fitness programs. And I'm back to... I'm going to go as hard as I can, and provided that I've repaired the rest of my body and I'm not in adrenal burnout or any sort of manifestation of that, that I'm fit and recovered and rested and ready to go work hard, I'll work hard. And I'll work hard for a brief enough period of time, again, anywhere from 20 minutes to 45 minutes. I mean, I did a hard workout today, 45 minutes. And I know it's hard for me when I when I stand up from whatever – thing I'm doing, and all of a sudden I think, oh, I'm having a stroke because I don't remember anybody's name. I'm looking at these people around me, and I can't. And yet, it's the lightheadedness that comes from having gone to the well pretty deeply. But then going home, knowing, all right, I did what I had to do. I'm confident that my body's going to respond in a way that gets me the result that I want. And the good news is, I get to sleep in. No, I get to not do it. I get to do it, not do it tomorrow or the next day.
And we would argue that sleeping in is very helpful as well.
Yeah. I actually don't know what sleeping is, but
you, we talked about that at PaleoFX, and you were talking about prioritizing sleep every night. So you should never need to sleep in if you're getting enough sleep every night.
That's exactly right. That's the point. I was just in Belize on vacation with my extended family. We took 12 family members to Belize for a week. It was really kind of nice. We went scuba diving and paddling every day, or snorkeling, I should say, not scuba. But I was the first one up every morning at 7 o'clock because that's just what time, you know, was appropriate for me to get up. Even though we never stayed up late. You know, we'd go to bed at a great time, an appropriate time, and I'd get my 8 hours, sometimes 8.5, and that, you know, I'm pretty adamant about that. And for me, it is because I can't sleep late. It just doesn't work for me to sleep late. It just means that I have to put myself to bed at an appropriate time. So I've never pulled an all-nighter in my life, for instance. You know, my daughter went to art school. She pulled 20 all-nighters 1 year getting projects done. I can no more fathom that than I can, you know, sailing to the moon.
Having done pretty close to all-nighters. I had in my first postdoctoral research fellowship, I had a series of experiments that were 20 hours from beginning to end. And that was as close to an all-nighter as I'd ever pulled. But
And how did it feel? How'd you recover from it?
Well, I was morbidly obese and had 12 different immune diseases. So
how's that working for you?
Clearly things are different now.
Yeah.
That was when my health was at its worst and I was severely depressed and I had anxiety attacks and I was nearly 300 pounds. And yeah, I mean, there was a lot of other stress and bad habits and everything else contributing to that at that time. But, it's not something that I think any educational program or career should expect of the people doing it. Like right. It's one of the problems in our society that we think it's okay for, you know, interns to be on 36-hour shifts. And we think that that's good training for them as doctors. Like that's ridiculous.
It's beyond ridiculous. It's criminal. But that's just my opinion.
You know what? This show would not be a show without a soapbox somewhere. And Stacey hasn't gone on one yet, which is a little bit weird. I'm just saying, Stacey.
What?
I'm just saying, you haven't done a soapbox yet.
Well, I haven't needed to. Mark's done them for me.
So,
there you go.
So I just want to go back to sort of summarizing the more practical aspect of what you were talking about, sort of eating for performance and eating for, you know, gaining, you know, strength and agility and motility and endurance in the gym. So you're more of a fan of just sort of eating to fuel your body appropriately throughout the day, but not necessarily pre-workout and post-workout and liquid calories and shakes and all of these things that aren't just things that the paleo movement, you know, experiments with, but is, you know, dogma in some gyms that it's the only way to recover from an intense workout.
Yeah, I mean, the dogma in the fitness industry for the last 20 years was 5 to 6 small meals spread throughout the day. Humans are grazers. We're meant to graze. Don't go anywhere without a full Tupperware kit full of a little bit of protein, some carbohydrate, and not much fat. I mean, these are all old school sugar burner mentalities. And the idea behind the Primal Blueprint is to become as good as possible at burning fat, to be so efficient at extracting your stored body fat from the fat cells and burning it as fuel instead of relying on sugar, that if you get to the point where you have to skip a meal, or you're forced to skip a meal, you choose to skip a meal, or you cut back on calories, your body just takes those calories from your thighs or from your back or from your arms or wherever the excess fat has been deposited and uses it as fuel. So that's sort of the main kind of goal behind Primal Blueprint Living, is to become a fat-burning beast. And with that comes all of these other side attributes, one of which is your hunger sort of mitigates. So you don't find yourself living meal to meal, or thinking about what that morning snack is and then thinking about lunch will be, and agonizing because you didn't bring enough in your Tupperware to get you through till dinner. All of that goes away. That's one of the best testimonials we get for having embarked upon a Primal Blueprint eating strategy, is you unburden yourself of this living meal to meal, which so many people in this country otherwise are tied to. The idea that if you are good at burning fat and you don't rely so much on glucose or a fresh supply of carbohydrate to create glucose, you don't cannibalize muscle tissue. So that's one of the great issues with people who are sugar burners, is that when you don't give a sugar burner more sugar, more glucose, more carbohydrate, and they don't know how to burn fat as effectively, the body says, oh crap, look, we're out of sugar. What are we going to do? I know, let's cause the adrenal glands to secrete more cortisol, which will then send throughout the bloodstream, and it'll literally strip the muscles of amino acids, send those amino acids to the liver to be converted into glucose, gluconeogenesis, to fuel the brain and fuel the muscles. Well, that's kind of a stupid way to live your life, is be in fear of cannibalizing yourself because you don't eat every 3 hours. So when you become a fat-burning beast, when you become good at burning fat, this doesn't happen anymore. Now if you skip 6 hours or you go a day and a half without eating, intermittent fasting, you don't burn muscle tissue because your body knows how to burn fat and your brain knows how to burn ketones. And you don't have to be in ketosis to burn ketones. It's not like you have to go, you know, all in on the whole ketogenic thing. It's just – it's a skill that you develop partly from getting rid of the crap, that is getting rid of the sugars, the processed grains and all that stuff, partly from getting rid of the industrial seed oils. And – does it mean you have to give up the rice, the safe starches? No, not really. It just means you cut back on them to what we would call an appropriate amount. So, you know, fueling for performance is part and parcel of just fueling for lifestyle. It's like, okay, the same diet that gets me through the day as a non-athlete can probably get me through the day as an athlete, with a couple of maybe minor variations if I'm going to do some horrendous Metcon workout tomorrow. I might want to top off my glycogen stores tonight, but it's not. You know, it doesn't change the whole game plan entirely. It's just a little adjustment. I tell people, I savor every bite of food I take. I will not put something in my mouth unless it's going to taste good. So I don't choke down, you know, oil-free kale salad just because it's supposed to be healthy for me. I mean, I want to enjoy every bite of food I eat. And one of the things I've noticed in my recent 15 years, or maybe even most recently in the last 10 years, is that I can do everything I do now on probably 30 to 35% fewer calories than I used to do the same stuff. So I'm looking at the human body going, well, you know, that's pretty interesting. I'm not hungry. I don't overeat even when I'm, even if I am hungry, I know when to stop. I maintain my muscle mass. I'm able to get through my really hard workouts without any kind of damage to the tissue because of my diet choice. I'm able to play 2 hours of Ultimate Frisbee as hard as possible on a Sunday afternoon. And, you know, with all of that, I enjoy the food I eat, but I don't need a lot of it. And I don't find myself wishing I were eating more. You know, Matt Stone has this thing called 180 Degrees of Health. And he's a interesting character who's got a spin on body temperature. Are you familiar with his site?
No, I'm not.
Okay, anyway.
I've heard of it, and it's a lot of biohacking stuff, right?
Yeah, it is. And his thing is eat as much as you can and not gain weight. You know, eat as much as you can and not gain weight. That's what the human body is designed to do. And I'm looking at it from the exact opposite spectrum, which is eat as little as you can, don't go hungry, and don't sacrifice lean tissue. And a lot of things happen. Number one, you live longer because we know that, and you get sick less often. And if you can mitigate the hunger that used to drive your life, why is that a bad thing? If you're eating less but you're not hungry, where's the harm? You know, if you're maintaining your muscle mass and your energy levels and everything else.
So
that's sort of what you know drives my eating strategy.
I wish that I had had this podcast with you about 8 weeks ago, because I did this experiment with carb cycling, which is pretty much, and I realize now, from the idea of putting my metabolism back to being a sugar burner. And I did it for 3 weeks, and I'm 3 weeks out, still kind of working on getting my body back to being what Sarah and I kind of call fat adapted. We like to be flexible so that, you know, we're not permanently in ketosis, but like you described, we can skip a meal and it not be the end of the world. I have been meaning to do kind of a blog post follow-up to people, because they've been asking me like, oh, are you still doing that? And pretty much my answer is like, no, it didn't work for me at all. I thought that it was going to help with my performance in the gym and maybe help me lean out, and it did the opposite. It did the opposite. So it's all the things that I kind of already knew, but I think for me, I've been living this lifestyle for 4.5 years and have only, you know, within the last kind of 9 months gone on to be a competitive athlete. And with that, I've been experimenting with being both a real foods eater, as well as, okay, now how do I modify kind of my lifestyle and what I eat to now, you know, changing my life and what my goals are. And so it's an interesting experiment for me. I don't know that I wouldn't have done it. I think it was a good learning lesson for me, but you pretty much just described exactly why it didn't work. So now, instead of doing my own thing on it, I can just say, yes, Mark, what you just said is why carb cycling didn't work for me, and I'm not going to address it any further.
It's good that you did it, because now you know. I mean, sometimes there's that lingering doubt, like, okay, I've given up all this stuff. Was it really necessary to give up all this stuff? Because really and truly, the primal blueprint is about enjoying your life. It is about, how do I get the most out of life, which includes, you know, health and fitness. But it also includes happiness, contentment, satisfaction, joy.
And it was Primal Connection was the name of the book, where you talked a lot about that, right? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it isn't just about, oh my God, you got to eat this way to be, you know, healthy, and that's the end of that. No, it's about how do I eat the kind of foods that I think I want to eat, and the ones that I'll eliminate the ones that I know are bad for me. But, you know, heaven forbid I eliminate the ones that I think are bad for me and they're not. Yeah, so you never know that you aren't giving up some tasty foods that you didn't have to give up until you introduce them back in and see what happens. And if it doesn't work for you, you go, okay, now I know that style of eating doesn't work for me. Now I'm happy to go about what I was doing before, but armed with a little bit more reassurance that I'm on the right path.
Yeah. And it's no fun to eat carbs without fats. Like, I thought it was going to be all exciting. Like, oh, I get to eat all these carbs. And then I realized, like, if you can't put butter or fat or something on a carb, it's really not tasty.
I mean, for the longest time I've said, look, grains are just beige glop that converts to glucose pretty quickly in the bloodstream. And that's the best thing you can say about them. Otherwise, they don't taste that great. You know, who likes a bowl of oatmeal with nothing on it? Who likes dry toast without jam or butter or sugar? Who likes truly likes a baked potato with nothing else on it, although that's not a grain? But the idea is that you're right, that we like our carbs to come accompanied with fats. And in the case of grains, it's incumbent upon us. I mean, and you know, we put on the sauces, the cheeses, the dressings, and all the stuff that we put on, say, pasta. Well, eliminate the pasta and just have the bowl of meatballs with marinara sauce. It's probably one of it's a better meal, and it probably tastes better.
Yep.
So one of the things that Stacy and I have been talking a lot about is, you know, this idea of being fat adapted or maintaining your metabolic flexibility, which, you know, we clearly see with people who are eating large amounts of carbohydrates, a lot of refined carbohydrates, that they their bodies don't switch into consuming, you know, using fat as fuel as well as they use carbohydrates as fuel. And I think with the growing number of people who are experimenting with ketogenic diets, we almost see the reverse, right? It's a lack of metabolic flexibility where they have a really hard time when they have carbohydrates because they're insulin resistant from not eating any carbohydrates, and they end up with blood sugar spikes, and they have a really hard time switching into using carbohydrates as fuel. So when we talk about, you know, the ideal is having a body that will just switch back and forth depending on what's there without any stress on the body whatsoever. And I think that, you know, part of this is the food choices we make, but the other huge part of this is the lifestyle factors, you know, reducing chronic stress, getting enough sleep, you know, being active, building muscle. Do you have, like, can you condense, you know, like a few tips for like what you think are the most important factors for having a really flexible metabolism, one that, you know, is very, very happy to run on fat, doesn't mind if it's skipping a meal. But if you do have a bowl of rice with a meal, isn't going to freak out that you just
have no,
rice.
It's so, a couple of great points there. I think that living a life in ketosis is probably inappropriate for most people. However, cyclic ketogenesis, getting in there every once in a while and being ketogenic or being keto adapted or being in ketosis or whatever the term you want to use, once in a while for a few days to a few weeks at a time and then coming back out is probably very helpful for metabolic flexibility. The more that you can create this, what we call the mitochondrial biogenesis, the ability of the body to burn fat is largely dependent on the mitochondria, these little powerhouses in the cell. And people who are sugar burners, since most glucose is burned outside the cell, very little is burned or outside the mitochondria, very little is burned in the mitochondria. That's mostly reserved for fatty acid beta oxidation of fats. So they don't have a need for maintaining a large supply of mitochondria. If you're a sugar burner, your body is so used to getting glucose and this easy burning fuel that the body doesn't want to create any system that it can't keep up without a lot of energy unless it really needs it. Now, when we get into that whole fat adaptation and we start cutting the carbs and cutting the sugars and cutting back on the grains and limiting our carbohydrates to maybe those that would come from vegetables and a little bit of fruit, that's a sort of a signal to the body. We need to build more mitochondria. If we're gonna be deficient, as it were, in glucose on a regular basis, let's learn how to burn fat. Let's create more of these fat burning enzymes and engines, and that's literally an epigenetic response to a low carb diet is mitochondrial biogenesis. The cells, particularly in the muscle, make more mitochondria, and in the brain as well, and the mitochondrial DNA make those mitochondria more efficient at putting through fats. So now you have this ability to burn fats because you've also reduced the amount of insulin. You can take the fat out of storage and use it as a fuel on a ready as needed basis, and it becomes a wonderful thing. Now, if you are in ketosis all the time, you know, then you do encounter a situation where there is some requirement for glucose throughout the body. So the muscles tend to become a little bit insulin resistant because they want to reserve all the glucose for the brain. That's probably the mechanism of why very low carb diets create this insulin resistance once again. But the bottom line is, if you want to be metabolically flexible, I think it's appropriate to be in and out of ketosis. I think it's appropriate to still monitor your carbohydrate intake. I don't think anybody except the top athlete needs more than, say, 150 to 200 grams of carbs in a day. And even then, those are athletes who haven't become as fat adapted as I would like. Sleep, absolutely. I mean, cortisol does interfere and create insulin resistance. So you want to take care of your adrenals, and that means getting some sleep. You want to squeeze the muscles dry of glycogen, which is the picture I use. It's not really happening, but you want to wring them out with your hand.
That's what I'm picturing right now.
Grab your calf and just wring it out a couple of times, and that'll do the trick. No, you want to deplete glycogen with some intense work every once in a while, which is why we say sprint once a week, lift heavy things twice a week as sort of a program standard. And with all of that and the diet in line, you will create this metabolic flexibility so that your brain knows how to use the extra ketones generated by the fat that you're burning because you become so good at burning fat. You don't need to be in ketosis to have that happen. You've built the metabolic machinery, and that's really what the lower carb diets do, is they prompt this increase in metabolic machinery to burn fats, but it doesn't go away if you get out of ketosis. Those changes stay in the cells as long as they're it's felt that they're needed to put through more fat. Now, if you go back on a sugar burning diet for the next couple of weeks, the body will slowly get rid of the mitochondria because it says, "Well, we're not burning fat anymore. Why do we need these expensive powerhouses to generate energy from a fuel that we're not even using anymore?" So the body's pretty smart in its response to what we're doing. And of course, the whole strategy behind the Primal Blueprint is to understand what's going on and then make choices that will serve us best, understanding the science. So if I say I want to be a good fat burner, I have to understand that part of that means I have to create more mitochondria. How do I do that? Well, I do that partly with the style of eating and partly with a little bit of intermittent fasting and partly with a little bit of training. We're looking for these hidden genetic switches that we can turn on or off at will.
So then this is fascinating. I'm geeking out again. So then the other thing that makes me think of, though, is micronutrients required for optimal mitochondrial function. I'm just sort of thinking of like Dr. Terry Wall's work in, you know, really bringing attention to micronutrients that are required for mitochondria to work optimally. And that's why, you know, her suggestions are such a heavy focus on vegetables. Do you have like some micronutrients that you think are particularly important to sort of support, you know, fat adaptation from this perspective?
No, I mean, B vitamins are always involved in energy production. CoQ10 to a certain extent involved in energy production. Some of these you can get through – I'm a big fan of vegetables. So I would never tell anybody avoid vegetables because you're on a low-carb eating strategy. I think vegetables are an important part not only of accessing micronutrients from the diet, but just they just taste pretty darn good when you slather them with butter.
Well, that's the thing.
I don't want to omit anything that's going to taste good that otherwise is going to benefit me just because it has a couple of extra carbohydrates. But if you look at, you know, you could eat a salad, a bowl of steamed broccoli, and some asparagus spears in one day and not exceed 45 grams of carbs. So they don't, you know, vegetables by themselves do not present, green vegetables anyway, and red colorful vegetables, don't present a lot of carbohydrate content. Certainly not anything that would mess with your fat adaptation. You know, it's the sugars and the grains and all the other stuff that really messes with you.
When you count carbs, do you count fiber? Like when you say 150 to 200 grams, do you mean including fiber or?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't even count that closely, so I don't really count them anymore. And I need to be – I guess I need to be more specific about what that looks like because a lot of in fiber, a lot of what you're getting in resistant starch, for instance, is you're getting calories that will be converted into free fatty acids downstream. So that's kind of cool. So they're not really – even though they're listed on a supplement fact panel as a carbohydrate, they're being fed to certain bacteria to be converted into fatty acids. So somebody needs to get together with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and explain that.
I think there's quite a few things people need to explain.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't really, you know, I don't care about net carbs. I mean, you'd be hard pressed if you were taking in 150 grams of carbs a day and 120 of them are net carbs. It's not that huge a difference, really.
I ask mostly because I get asked that question all the time. Do you count fiber? Really what do you mean? Do you mean net or do you mean gross? What do you,
I know.
Like, what's a carb?
Yeah.
And I say, just eat some vegetables.
That's it. I say eat vegetables with reckless abandon. You know, it's the fruit that's really going to be the issue for a lot of people. The vegetables, it's, you'd be hard pressed to overdo your vegetables, really. If you haven't
seen my plates. I'm just
okay.
Well, that's the thing is, but you're not overdoing them. Like, it's impossible.
I eat huge quantities of non-starchy vegetables, but I don't. I eat very measured portions of starchy vegetables, and these days, not very much fruit at all, actually.
Right. Awesome. Well, Mark, we've taken up so much of your time, but it has been fantastic to pick your brain about some of the stuff that Sarah and I have been kind of offline pontificating about since we ourselves have taken on more physical activities. So thank you so much for allowing us to indulge ourselves and pick your brain.
Well, thank you for allowing me to run at the mouth.
Yeah, awesome. You are welcome to run at the mouth anytime you'd like. I just want to remind people where they can find you, and specifically if you're interested in a lot of the stuff that Mark talked about today, his book, The Primal Blueprint, or a lot of the stuff that he talked about is in Primal Connections. That's the one where you talk a lot about lifestyle and playing and getting in the dirt and all the interesting things that we talked about the last time you were on the podcast.
And introduced us to the concept of amber-tinted glasses.
Which, the way, after that podcast, I don't know if you know this, but after you were on the podcast and told about amber-tinted glasses, Sarah got a pair, and within like 2 or 3 weeks, the entire paleo community had amber-tinted glasses. And we never had an opportunity to talk to you afterwards to tell you that you yourself on this podcast started the amber-tinted glasses movement. So good job.
Cool. Good. Good. Plus, you look cool wherever you go. If you're going to anywhere after dark and you get your amber-tinted glasses on, you look a little bit like Bono or whatever.
Take those to the club with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an awesome fashion statement. This is what I keep trying to tell people. It doesn't matter that they're safety glasses. You can wear them anywhere.
Then, Mark, if people want to find out more about your new certification program or anything else, can you give them that information?
Sure. So, obviously, marksdailyapple.com is the main base of operation. If you're not a member, if you haven't signed up for a newsletter, go there and register. We have all kinds of great free goodies, downloadable PDFs and books and cookbooks and all kinds of strategies. And then primalblueprint.com is our commerce site where you can get our books. But most recently, you can find out about the Primal Blueprint Expert Certification Program. I've got a video where I'm riffing on it a little bit there, and a detailed explanation about what's in it and what's involved and what you get as a result of taking on this. I'm really proud of this program. It's almost 2 years of work that we put into this, and I think it's going to change the world. So there. There you have it.
And is there like a schedule already for locations or?
Well, no. So it's an online program. Thank you for asking.
Okay.
Yeah, no,
that's
it's an
even
online program.
Better.
So it's entirely, there's 110,000 words of text. There's videos and other stuff. There's 13 modules with an exam at the end of each module. You have to get a 70% to move on to the next one. If you don't pass, you get another exam to take, and then if that's the case and you don't, then we get a hotline because we want people to pass, so we'll help you through it. But it's like a third year college level course, because we want people to be clear that they understand the mechanisms behind the Primal Blueprint. They should know about mitochondrial biogenesis, for instance, and then take it out into either the workplace where they can increase their income, or take it to their friends and family where they can increase their credibility.
Awesome. And I'm sure that if you're, especially if like you're a blogger or something like that, it would be really beneficial as well, because having that information and being able to put it into context for readers and practical application would be really good as well. So, Awesome. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming back on as usual. It's been wonderful to have you. Thank you for your soapboxes and rants, because those are my favorite part of a podcast. And I got to listen to them today instead of give them.
Yeah. Well, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you ladies, and good on you for taking up this this athlete perspective. I love hearing that.
It's definitely unique from, you know, from like moms in their 30s who were professional couch potatoes to now. I don't know if you've heard this, but I've taken up the sport of strongman and actually qualified for nationals within the first year of doing it. And it's been a much different endeavor for me than the last few decades of my life.
And I'm thrilled to hear that. That's so cool.
Yeah. So this has been perfect timing for me, and I really appreciate you indulging. And it's timely to a lot of the other things that we've been talking about on the podcast. So, and I'm sure if people want more information on some of the stuff that we talked about, they can find it in your books, on your website, or especially in this new course that you're offering if they want new details. So thank you again, and we'll see you at PaleoFX, right?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. All
right, good. It'll be a party.
That's good.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Oh, hi, kitty. Are you going to do a podcast with me?
Well, neither of us drink, and so we were just kind of
talking about taking up the sport of drinking.
Here I've just given it up.
I am so lightweight that I get drunk off vanilla in a dessert.
I am evidently not at that level, because I was able to make a vaginal dryness joke in one presentation and be a complete doofus in the next. So I'm just not a PhD.
You're just saying you were never nervous talking in front of people.
That's true.
That you have no problem.
I have no problem
saying anything.
In a giant room full of people.
Hey, they laughed. It was effective.
They did laugh. It was a good bit. Thanks to somebody for putting that in your slide.
Yeah. Well, if it wouldn't have been that, I would have talked about explosive diarrhea. So.